We are going to take a look at canoes over the next 40 minutes or so. Larry Mueller here. I'm glad you're listening in on the Ideas Network. Our guests today are the authors of a great new book on the history of the canoe. It's called Canoes, A Natural History in North America. Mark Nugel is a professor of communication and journalism at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, a former wilderness guide and summer park ranger. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me on.
I really appreciate you joining in. Norman Sims is a retired honors professor from the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a longtime whitewater canoeist. You know, canoes played a very important part in our history, and we're going to talk about their origins and how they fit into your life and mine then and now, the lives of everybody. What are your memories of canoeing? What do you like? Why do you like canoes? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@wpr.org. Maybe you have a great picture from a canoeing adventure. I hope you'll post it on our Facebook page. Just search for The Larry Mueller Show. Norm Sims, again, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I tell you what. Well, you both are... I had a pretty early love for canoes. Did you not, Norm?
I did, although my first experience in a canoe was at Boy Scout camp, where we were told to paddle solo in rather large wooden canvas canoes around a pylon in the lake. I hated that. I didn't really know how to paddle the boat. But when I got a little bit older, I took a class in college on canoeing and have been... very enthusiastic about it ever since.
And Mark, your time, you go back to what? Well, you're 4 years old or something?
Well, yeah, you know, Larry, in the late 60s, my dad was kind of an early adopter sort of fellow. And when the first fiberglass canoes came out, he had to have one. And I was probably about 10. And it was just a perfect age for a boy growing up out in the country to have a new toy like a canoe with brothers and sisters who could also help paddle. So that's how it started for me.
How did you guys get together to write this history of canoes? And I have to tell you, it's a fascinating book. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, Norm and I knew each other kind of professionally over the years, and we actually shared an editor at one time, and the editor invited us to lunch, and he and I spent the entire lunch yammering on about canoes and boating, and at the end of it, she said, "You guys ought to do a book."
Oh, how many years ago was that? This must have taken a long time to put together.
It was so long ago, Larry, that I actually had hair then. He was wonderful. And I think a lot of what Mark and I talked about at that lunch was building wood strip boats. So the next summer, Mark was all excited about this, and he built a very nice wood strip boat, which I had done several times. And I had the pleasure of seeing it just a couple months ago when I went to Minneapolis. It's a nice boat.
Well, and isn't that the cedar boat that you built from the Boundary Waters incident, Mark?
That's right, Larry. You
tell that story.
Yeah, you remember, I'm sure, as do many of us who were here in 1999, the big blowdown in the Boundary Waters in the Quetico, the derecho event in July that year blew down, you know, a million acres of trees. And I was fortunate enough to have friends up on the Gunflint Trail who had a cabin, and they lost a lot of trees, or their relatives lost a lot of trees as well. And I was able to salvage some of that white cedar, which had been good and dried outside in the sun for several years, and use that to make the boat, or most of it. And so the cool thing was I was able to finish the boat and take the white cedar back to where it grew and paddle some of the property and some of the lakes and the rivers around where the trees used to live. And that kind of completed the circle.
I loved that story. I thought, what a wonderful story. I wanted to make sure we brought that up today on the show. Well, you know, we've got some great... callers online already. By the way, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you've got your own canoe history story to tell us. I hope you join in. 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And I love how you've got this your book designed and laid out. Talk about just tell us a little bit about how that's organized.
Well, this is Norm. We wanted to give credit to the Native Americans for their role in creating the canoe and evolving it over many, many generations. So we started with dugout canoes, which everyone thinks of as being in the Pacific Northwest, but they were actually equally important in the Caribbean and in Florida. Dugouts have been found that were 1,000 years old in Minnesota, 5,000 years old in Florida. Then, of course, the birch bark canoe, which is what most people think of as the original canoe. But it actually only occupied maybe a third of the United States and Canada where birch is available.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we, as historians, were trying to match the canoe up with what was going on around it, with the fur trade. And then later on with changing social mores in the country and eventually recreational activities that involved the canoe, much more than other things at the time, early in the 20th century. And then there's an environmental movement that starts in the 60s that was arrayed around human-powered travel. So the canoe had a big role to play in that as well.
Yeah, it really fascinating story. You know, when you mentioned dugout, one of the cool things about this book, by the way, is that in each chapter, I could call up a story of my own relating to the particular type of canoe you were talking about. When you mentioned dugout, when you wrote about it, I was in Puerto Cabezas, Nicaragua, which is over on the east side of the Nicaragua. And did some work with the Mosquito Indians there.
Oh, yeah.
And the mosquitoes would go out fishing in these dugout canoes, and they'd go sometimes a few miles out into the water in these dugouts and then capture fish, and then the 20 or 30 miles or whatever they had to paddle to get to Puerto Cabezas to sell the fish. And I looked at those dugouts, and I thought, man... I don't think it'd get me out in those, but they're pretty seaworthy.
They're a lot tougher people than we are, too, Larry. I just want to point that out.
It was fascinating to me, Larry, because when Columbus arrived, he was met by natives in long dugout canoes. Some of these canoes had 70 or 80 people in them.
Yeah.
He had never seen a boat like that. He had never seen a canoe paddle. They had rowboats. And he said, these canoes are so much faster. They travel from island to island to trade, to make war on each other. Now, these were ocean-going dugout canoes that were built with a little flare to the hull, as they were in the Pacific Northwest, so that they could handle the waves on the ocean. But it's just unimaginable to me how they could cut down a giant tree well over 1,000 years old, hollow it out, flare the hull, have it finely hewn, and they had no metal tools. They were using stone and shell.
Yeah, just absolutely amazing. But one of the cool things about the book are the amazing, you know, there's so many great adventures and stories that you've got in the book that I really enjoyed reading about. As well as, and I've got to bring this up, the photos and the that you have, the some of them very old, and the paintings that you were able to take photos of, it must have been a tough experience to put all that together. I mean, there's really some amazing work in there.
You know, we ended up, I think, with 320-some images, both paintings, photographs, maps, advertisements, sheet music about canoes. I think we started with well over 1,000 images when we first kind of got the project going. And the hard part was whittling it down to the ones we liked the best. I mean, there's so many that were great. And everybody kind of is attached or attracted to one particular image that's memorable. I'm sure you have one too, Larry, but, you know, we talk to people around the Midwest as we've been talking about canoes and about the book, and people will always come up and say, well, I really like that one picture you had, you know.
Well, I just getting permissions must have been a, that's what I've written a couple of books too, and just getting permissions must have been quite an experience.
Well,
we had a
very capable assistant in that regard, that's for sure.
We did. Christian at the University of Minnesota Press was wonderful, and I had a kind of nightmare permissions story, which I won't tell you in any detail, but the cover photograph.
Yeah, it's
the
beautiful.
The cover image on this book is a Winslow Homer watercolor that the original is owned by Harvard University. Well, having taught at the University of Massachusetts for 35 years, we tend to think of Harvard as the dark star in the eastern part of the state. Much money, so many good students. And I hesitated to call them about it because I feared it would cost a fortune. It turns out that Isabella Donadio, their permissions officer, was just extraordinarily helpful. We got the image. She gave us permission to use it on the cover as well. And it was not expensive at all. Harvard was an absolute sweetheart about that.
Duane in Hayward has something for us. Hi, Duane. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I own 7 canoes.
Oh, my goodness.
There's an intervention for that, Duane.
yeah, it's called Buy More. I grew up on the Nemecaga River, and I spent more time in the canoe hunting, fishing, and trapping than I ever did on a bicycle.
Sure.
And I go to the Boundary Waters regularly, and I've hauled canoes all west and fished all of them and canoed some of the bigger rivers out there, et cetera, et cetera. I grew up with wooden canvas canoes.
Yeah.
And I was never so glad to get rid of the wooden canvas canoe and go to the aluminum canoe. Because the older canoes are just heavy, heavy maintenance and very easy to damage.
Yeah.
And when you're using them for work, like trapping, you get in a lot of tough areas with lots of rocks and stumps. And now I have three Kelvars and one carbon fiber, which I use exclusively for lake travel up in the Boundary Waters. And the toughest canoes out there are the Old Town Polylinks. You can beat the crap out of them, and they keep on going.
There we go.
You probably had some either Shell Lake or Thompson wooden canvas boats in your background if you're from that part of the country.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, back in the late 50s and early 60s. So what brand they were, I don't know, but we were constantly working on trying to keep them afloat. And, you know, they absorb water. I mean, they're interesting canoes. They're great history, but when it comes to toughness and usefulness, the new materials are so far superior to the old materials.
Well, it's a lot less heavy, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you guys get into that too. I think your last chapters deal with, you know, sort of the newer materials, but I tell you, I still have a fondness for the old canoes.
Well, yeah, I do too, Duane. My background has been in whitewater paddling, primarily in plastic-decked canoes that look like kayaks. But at a certain point in my history, I found a wooden canvas canoe in the backyard of someone's house in Champaign, Illinois, restored the boat. And for me, it was the hull shape and the hull design in those wooden canvas canoes that made them interesting. The ones I have were made by Morris in Vesey, Maine in the 1890s. They were one step away from the birch bark. They had very similar hull designs. And I have a small collection of them, not quite as many canoes as you have, but I love paddling.
Pretty close, though.
Carrying them is a little bit heavier, certainly heavier than a carbon fiber boat. But the hull shapes are marvelous. I wish we can reproduce those in fiberglass, in carbon fiber. But the Old Town ABS plastic canoes have tended to be kind of blunt. The aluminum canoes mostly did not have as nice a shape. And, of course, they were very noisy. But nowadays, when we get into carbon fiber and Kevlar and fiberglass boats, some of them have tremendously great hulls, very fast, very stable.
It's interesting to me, and you point out in the book somewhere, I forget where, that, you know, if you brought somebody back to life from 1,000 years ago and showed them a canoe, they'd know exactly what it was.
That's right. Not only would they know what it was, they'd know what it was used for and how to drive it, too.
Yeah, that's one of the amazing things for me is that, all right, there's some slightly different designs or maybe quite a bit different designs, but in the end, everybody knows what a canoe is.
That's right, and everybody has this canoe story, too. If you think about it, Larry, we saw one estimate where there are 23 million canoeists in the United States in any given year. That's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. Yeah, and you know what? I hope you sell a lot of books to those people, and I frankly think that people who don't canoe would certainly become interested in it after reading your book. We're talking today with Mark Nugel and Norman Sims, who are the authors of Canoes, A Natural History in North America. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Talking today with Mark Nugel and Norman Sims, authors of Canoes, A Natural History in North America. Great to have them with us, and certainly if you want to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Jeff in Madison has a story for us, I believe. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. Glad to be listening to your show. One of the first Father's Day presents I ever got when we were on a canoe trip in the Boundary Waters was up in Ely. My wife got me a shirt with about 10 different Native American canoe styles on it, and they ranged from canoes from Maine all the way to Minnesota, so it was very interesting to see how various Native communities changed or altered the designs of canoes to fit whatever their needs were. But my story is that I was in one of the earlier, that I'm aware of, earlier mass participation canoe events, which was a canoe race on Lake Michigan sponsored by the Lackey Joy Company in about 1965. They're an outdoor goods company in Milwaukee. And the race was outside the Milwaukee Breakwater, starting from like McKinley Park, someplace on the north, and then going down past the Milwaukee Harbor outside the breakwater down to South Shore Park, I believe it was. So it was a fairly long race. And we got going on a beautiful day, although the wind started to pick up and the waves started to roll. And I started to look around. I was 17 at the time, and we were paddling pretty good. And I started to notice boats, motorboats over by some canoes, and people had turned over because they just weren't used to the big waves. And as we kept going, I looked again out to the open lake to my left and saw a huge C&O car ferry coming across from Lake Michigan.
Never a good sign.
Did somebody not communicate with the ferry company that just we were going to be a couple hundred canoes going out across the breakwater? So my dad and I just paddled like crazy, and I was getting pretty tired. But we got across the opening to the harbor where the ship was heading, and then I looked again and saw that the ship had slow and was able to turn and avoid what could have been a pretty bad calamity.
Oh.
But we kept going along the breakwater then, but then the waves came from the boat, came in and hit the breakwater and bounced back off the breakwater, and we were rocking and rolling for quite a ways. It was quite an exciting event. I thought, this is really cool. I'd like to do this again. But and my parents had gotten this aluminum Grumman canoe for going down the Wolf River at the time, right when I started my first summer job. So I had to work on weekends when they were free, so I never got to go paddle the Wolf. But one day they came back with the hull cracked in the bottom. They had wrapped around the rapids at Oxbow on the Wolf River. So they let me repair it, but I never got to paddle the Wolf in that canoe.
Well, you know, this is starting to disturb me because about every fourth story we hear is a disaster of some sort.
Yeah, I know, but we all have those stories. I've got a few almost disaster stories of my own, which I won't go into right now. Jim, thanks a lot, Jeff. Jim in Wadsworth, Illinois has something for us. Hi, Jim.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for this great show. Thank you for your authorship. I look forward to getting a copy of your new book on the subject. I'm personally on this subject a descendant of Ralph Fries of the Chicagoland Canoe Base.
Oh yeah,
wonderful man.
Yeah.
And anyway, one of the first things that you learned from him on this subject is that you've already touched on a little bit, is that this is canoe is a worldwide phenomenon, and the dugout is such a basic concept. It probably almost certainly got started many different places across the globe. It is the world's most versatile watercraft. Unfortunately, too many people think that the only place to paddle a canoe is in a wilderness setting, and a day trip almost anywhere can be enjoyable, although not like the last caller indicated, not every situation is for the total beginners.
That's right.
Yeah. So,
thank you very much. And it really, Jim's really exactly right. It's a worldwide phenomenon, and it must have just sort of popped up.
It was one of those particular pieces of technology that was developed to meet needs, but it was probably developed simultaneously across several cultures because the answer seemed, well, it seems to us now in retrospect to be fairly obvious. We need a long, skinny boat that doesn't weigh very much, that can be made out of the trees, and doesn't cost as much either. And that many cultures arrived at the same conclusion at the same time.
A previous caller mentioned seeing a number of dugouts in South America. That's where I have seen a lot as well. And for this book, I went to the island of Dominica in the Caribbean to interview a man named Napoleon Sanford, who's a Carib Indian.
Mm-hmm.
He still makes dugout canoes from the gomier trees on Dominica. They're beautiful. And they were made in lots of places where birch bark wasn't available. They were worldwide. The other thing that I think Jeff said earlier about getting that T-shirt on a trip to the Boundary Waters, there's a book called The Bark and Skin Boats of North America by Chappelle and Adney. It has photographs, drawings of all of the birch bark canoes made by the North American natives. That book suggests a tremendously wide range of boats. Some of them were crooked for use in whitewater. Some of them were very flat and stable, say, for harvesting wild rice in northern Minnesota. But when Jeff said that, I thought that no matter what kind of boat you're paddling or what it's made of, the experience of gliding away from shore over a glassy wake and glassy lake in the Boundary Waters just hasn't changed at all for thousands of years.
You're exactly right. Bob in Pleasant Prairie has something for us. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to report in my grandfather and his neighbors actually found a dugout in 1933 on Lake Auburn, which is on the west side of Minneapolis, about 25 miles right off of Highway 5 there. And they went in with their horse teams and pulled it out. But this one and another one that they pulled it, not this, my grandparents, but some fellows pulled out of Lake Minnetonka, they say that one's built somewhere between 1025 and 1165. And they're putting that one at 1,000 years old, whereas the one that my grandfather helped pull out, which is now in the Minnesota Historical Society, it's about 16 feet long, and they're saying red oak, but it's 300 pounds. And I went a couple summers ago. We still own the farm up there. And I went up and did some research and got to go up on a lift to actually see the one, because it's not on direct display right now, the one pulled up out of Lake Auburn. And, it's very skinny. I would think maybe three people could be in it, but 300 pounds, and Lake Auburn's not a large lake.
Right. So I've had the opportunity to do that too, and the couple things that are interesting to me about both of those boats, one is the tremendous sense of balance that the paddlers had to have, because you didn't really get the width, at least that I'm comfortable with. The second thing is the I think they know or they're guessing that the Lake Auburn boat was an oak species of some sort, but the Minnetonka boat, they're not sure what kind of wood it was made out of.
Well, I know that in the research that I did, the one out of Lake Auburn there, they said they sent pieces of wood down to Madison there, to the
yep.
forest lab.
That's right.
And somebody was saying black oak and, you know, so forth and so on. But it's a skinny little guy and 300 pounds. That's I'm thinking, how would they transport it from that relatively small lake? Actually, that area now is the Carver County Park Reserve.
That's right.
And that used to be our land on the edge of that, plus a small island that was in there. And, of course, when that park preserve went in the early 70s, that was all eminent domain. So we lost about 13 acres there. But the story, I always remember hearing that when I was a kid, and I was fascinated by the story. So being up there and doing work on the old farmhouse, which is log and Chaska brick exterior, now I thought, well, I'm going to look that up. And sure enough, I was able to find it and go in and see it in the historical society there. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to guess that story probably never left that lake. At 300 pounds. I'm thinking they just kept it there.
Yeah.
There's a story that I picked up in my research from Peterborough, Ontario, where the Canadian Canoe Museum is located. It's kind of about 70 miles northeast of Toronto. Apparently, in the 1850s, some guys were on a fishing trip with a 200-pound dugout canoe. That's what the Indians up there made. They didn't make birch bark at that time. So they had a couple of three-mile portages. And then one of them decided there had to be a better way. He started making board canoes. These were all-wood canoes that, for the rest of that century, became the hallmark of modern canoeing. The best all-wood canoes were built in Peterborough, Ontario. Fabulous boats, but it was the weight that literally broke their back. So they had to design something new.
Bob, thanks again for calling. Lucas in Wakana, Iowa, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Lucas.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What have you got for us today?
Well, I'm an avid canoer from the Driftless down here in Iowa. I spend trying to get out 12 months a year if I can. And knock on wood, I've never tipped a canoe, actually. I had to throw that out there. But I recently read the Northwest Passage, and they mention how the Chippeways were the best paddlers for that money could buy. And they also mention the French Voyager canoes, which, by the sounds of the book, were extremely large canoes. And I was wondering if you could just give me a little background on those.
Sure. Mark or Norm, you want to?
That's Mark's.
Mark?
Yeah. Voyager canoes came in three sizes, basically. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit here or generalizing a little bit, but as you might imagine, it took a different kind of a boat to get across Lake Superior as opposed to kind of up in your area, you know, on the Turkey River or wherever it might be. But and so three basic sizes of boats depending on what they were hauling. And, of course, the bigger the water, the bigger the boat was a general rule of thumb there. But I'm in agreement to a certain degree on that the Ojibwe or the Chippewa, as they were called, built just a beautiful, beautiful boat. Really pretty to look at. Just had the fine form. Those boats were actually built in a couple different generations. There's an early form and a late form, but they're quite spectacular to look at. I agree.
Thank you so much for that call. We've got some interesting posts on Facebook. Lynn sent a little video of a canoe luge into the lake where there's...
call that an otter entry.
I'm watching it right now. They slide down on the snow and into the lake, and that is a pretty cool post. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you'll see that as well. That's a great... And Jeremy posted a photo of his family in their canoe. He says he likes... row trolling in his aluminum Myers sports bow. He says it's very light for carrying. and a cool photo there. Stephen in Door County, your turn. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. Good morning. I just had a. I wanted to share a documentary that I saw that was just mind blowing. It's called Caesar's Bark Canoe, and I believe it was filmed in 71 by a native 120 miles north of Montreal, and it just shows him chopping down a birch tree, harvesting the bark, and making a canoe out of all the material around his property there, or in the reservation, and if you're interested in building a birch bark canoe, this is something to see. I'm sure y'all probably have heard of that. Caesar's Bark Canoe by the Canadian Historical Society. That's all I had to say.
Oh, thank you so much. Are you guys familiar with it, Mark? Are you?
Yeah, and I'll put in a plug for the Canadian Film Board, too. Several documentary-style documentary-style films and other types of films that they have produced over the years is really a valuable resource, for us, and we're appreciative of that.
Yeah.
I had a comment about something. I think it was Luke, the previous caller, mentioned the quality of the voyageurs and paddling, which was very true. These were fabulous, generally French Indian paddlers. But we publish an excerpt from Alexander Mackenzie's journals. He went in 1793 to the Pacific Ocean by canoe. He got there 10 years ahead of Lewis and Clark, who went overland.
Yeah.
And he left Montreal with voyageur paddlers. And he said in his journal, well, let me say, once they got to the Rocky Mountains and the Sierras, they had to leave behind their birch barks. When they came down the west side, they traveled with Indians in dugout canoes. And he said, I had imagined that the Canadians who accompanied me were the most expert canoemen in the world, but they are very inferior to these people, as they themselves acknowledged in conducting those vessels. Those Indians brought them down steep whitewater rivers coming down the mountains. When they came to a problem area, they would put the Europeans on shore and let them walk around, and then they'd paddle the canoes through themselves.
That was a great story. Sort of along those lines, but more modern day. Dave posted on Facebook that it's amazing how well aluminum canoes can handle whitewater rapids, unless, of course, it turns sideways and turns into a taco.
Yeah, and then you need a can opener to get it out.
Oh, man. Leslie and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm up in Rhinelander, but I've lived, well, I grew up in North Shore, so Marblehead on the ocean, and half of my life on the islands in Hawaii and then in the Caribbean. And you were talking about the Carib Indians. My daughter's a Carib Indian, and I've worked and raced with outrigger canoes and sailboats. And you were talking about South America, and the Carib Indians came, and the Arawaks came out of the Orinoco River in Venezuela. And so when you mentioned about where the canoes had actually emigrated, that's actually where they started. And each generation would send out another generation of their indigenous, whether it was Carib or the Lucayans or the Arawaks, into the Caribbean. And where the Caribs are on, as you well know, on the island of Dominica, which I had lived on, in Celebia, they actually have...
that's where Napoleon lives, too. Mm.
Yes, yes. And so I know that area quite well. It's kind of a, you know, part of a home base for me. They have... Did you see the altar that they have? They've got an altar in one of the churches, and it's a dugout canoe. That's their altar.
Oh.
And also they would, as you well know, because they were the warriors, the Caribs, they would attack the French warships with their dugout canoes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Fearsome. So you have this different types of canoes, the ones that they would get used for going for fishing, and then traveling throughout the islands, and then the war canoes as well, which I find, you know, in the other islands as well, like the Hawaiian Islands and in New Zealand, they also have the war canoes. And I was wondering if you had addressed that in your book about these different types of canoes, the war canoes and the outrigger canoes that are, you know, used throughout the Pacific Islands.
One of the things I wrote about, and I'm really glad that you mentioned the Caribbean and Hawaii because they have so much in common when it comes to canoes. The canoe is revered in Hawaii because that's how the original settlers arrived, coming out of Southeast Asia across a vast ocean in actually double-hulled canoes. They weren't just outriggers. They had two hulls with a platform between. Those people actually had sails. The ones in the Caribbean did not. How many people were lost at sea trying to settle that area is, of course, unknown. But if you look on a map, Hawaii is just a little dot in the middle of a vast Pacific Ocean. They sailed against the trade winds to get there, and somehow they found it. They brought with them plants and animals that are still present in Hawaii today. It was a wonderful story. Those canoes, the double-hulled canoes, were not seen by Europeans until Captain Cook got there in the late 1700s. And we have drawings that were made at the time.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. Leslie, thank you so much. Neil in Slinger, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Neil.
Hi. I only have two canoes, an original birch bark and an old town. That was canvas, but what I want to tell you about is at Lake Nakabay, in the tavern above the outlet, if you go up the west side, there were two original dugouts that when they were cleaning up for swimming beach, they pulled them out. They probably weighed them down with stones in the winter.
Sure.
Seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were hanging in the tavern for many years. New owner came, thought that would be a good idea to put them outside on display. Poured two concrete slabs, left some paddles, and the concrete is still there, but the canoes are gone. The end of them. And next thing, Lac des Flambeaux Museum has a nice big dugout, and there was a lump of clay in it that they still left in there. It's in the museum. It's a beautiful dugout canoe, and I don't know any of its history. And one more thing about diffusion of technology. The Oreken, and O-R-E-Q-U-E-N possibly is a spelling. This is from memory. Northeast China still make, or were still making birch bark canoes in the 50s when the anthropologists in China documented it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. The Russians did build birch bark canoes, and in fact still do today.
It's a great story. And you know, guys, thank you so much, by the way, Neil, for calling in. We have more callers online, and we're about out of time here. You know, one of the things I wanted to mention, I was so happy to see that the University of Minnesota Press published your book, because I without even opening it, I knew it was going to be a beautifully done book. So the book itself is beautiful just to look at, and the writing is great, and the photos are hardly not to be believed. Guys, I want to thank you so much. We could go on all day, I think, talking about this, but I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today, and I hope a lot of people read your book.
Well, thank you, Larry, and thanks to everyone who called in. This has been really interesting.
Been a lot of fun. Mark Nugel, Professor of Communication and Journalism at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota. Norman Sims, retired honors professor from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And he's written quite a few books, as a matter of fact. This is his sixth book with Mark, this one with Mark. And it's called Canoes, A Natural History in North America, published by the University of Minnesota Press. And we have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show to the book. And there's, I hope you'll go to our Facebook page, because there's a wonderful photo or two. And there's also a nice video of a canoe luge into the lake, which has to be seen to be believed. Great talking with those guys. And you know what? We're going to stay on the water in a way, because our next guests are going to be talking about a new tool for testing water quality. Got people from the Center for Limnology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. That coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.